Israeli forces clash with thousands of protesters who demand the resignation of the regime's prime minister and a deal with Hamas on captives. And Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps reiterates its pledge to punish Israel for the recent deadly attack on the Iranian embassy in Syria. Thank you for joining us. Palestinians in the Gaza Strip are witnessing an endless spiral of death and devastation, with the Israeli genocide now in its seventh month. According to the Palestinian sources, Israeli attacks killed 46 and injured scores more in the past 24 hours. Israeli warplanes bombed various areas in the southern city of Khan Yunis. The regime's army also carried out heavy artillery shelling on Gaza City in north of the territory. Over 33,100 people, mostly women and children, have been killed in Gaza since Israel launched its onslaught on the territory on October the 7th. Nearly 76,000 have also been injured. Moreover, at least 7,000 people are unaccounted for or presumed dead under the rubble. The World Health Organization says Israel has reduced Gaza's largest hospital to ashes, turning it into an empty shell with human graves. The WHO said most of the buildings in the hospital complex have been extensively destroyed and the majority of assets have been damaged. It says even restoring minimal functionality seems implausible in short term. This after the UN agency's mission finally accessed the hospital following several failed attempts. The WHO says at least five dead bodies were found during the mission. Israeli forces pulled out of the Al-Shifa hospital on Monday after a two-week military operation. Al-Shifa was Gaza's most important medical complex. According to WHO, only less than 30% of Gaza's main hospitals are partially operational now. Our correspondent Moti Abu Musabe joined us earlier from the central Gaza city of Deir al-Balah with more details. Let's take a listen.
The western parts of Khan Yunis city have been subjected to brutal, continuous Israeli attacks that have been targeting and destroying the residential buildings using the Israeli war jets, alongside the continuous attacks and the blowing up of the Palestinian residential buildings and the Palestinian houses. The entire areas of the western parts of Khan Yunis city were reduced to rubble over those incessant and chronic Israeli attacks and airstrikes. In the meantime, the eastern parts as well, these movements, they are being targeted heavily by the Israeli occupation warplanes and the Israeli artillery shelling after the Al-Qassam brigades actually announced that they have killed roughly 14 Israeli soldiers. In the meantime, when it comes to the central area of Gaza Strip, as you know, the Israeli artillery actually has been attacking the northern part of the central area of Gaza Strip, particularly Al-Mughraga neighborhood. Several residential buildings were targeted heavily by the chronic Israeli shelling. In the meantime, the Israeli occupation forces on the ground blasted and blew up several residential buildings in that area, particularly in Al-Mughraga neighborhood. So we are talking about continuous Israeli airstrikes and attacks that are still hitting and destroying more residential buildings and areas.
Israeli security forces have once again attacked anti-Netanyahu protesters in Tel Aviv, calling for early elections and a captive exchange deal with Hamas. One of the demonstrators can be seen being pushed to the ground and led away by the police. Chanting "Elections now," protesters call for Netanyahu's resignation as the Israeli onslaught on Gaza enters its seventh month. Rallies were also held in other cities. Organizers say over 100,000 protesters had attended the rallies. Meantime, Israeli media have reported a car ramming incident near the protests, in which five protesters were run over by a driver who refused to obey police instructions. Medical sources said one of them was in critical condition and the rest were lightly wounded. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas says it will not back down from its previous position in ceasefire talks as it sends a delegation for renewed talks in Cairo over the weekend. In a statement, Hamas said that, according to its position presented on March 14th, it demands a complete ceasefire and the withdrawal of Israeli forces from Gaza. Hamas said it also wants the return of the displaced people to their homes and freedom of movement for Palestinians. The demands also include the release of Palestinian prisoners in return for Israeli captives. The ceasefire talks are expected to resume over the weekend as the Israeli onslaught reaches the six-month mark. Former U.S. government advisor Paul Larudi joined us earlier. He said the status quo in Gaza ceasefire talks is pretty much an impasse as Israel wants to eliminate all Palestinians from their own land. Let's take a listen.
They're not going to give up their bargaining chips when if their demands haven't been met. And if they give up the only bargaining chips they have, then they're not going to get the rest of their demands. On the other hand, the Israelis won't even accept, let's say, the way it used to be before October 7th. They want actually to eliminate a segment of the, preferably all of the Palestinian population. And they want to rule from the river to the sea and to have all of it without the Palestinian people being there. So I think it's basically an impasse.
Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps has vowed to make the Zionist regime regret its attack on Iran's diplomatic mission in Syria. The statements by the IRGC said they will punish the regime and its backers for what it called the cruel terrorist attack in Damascus. The statement also thanks the Iranian nation for the million-strong funeral processions in Iran on Friday that also marked the International Quds Day. It said the massive participation of Iranians in the rallies was a source of hope for the oppressed Gazans and strengthened the resolve of the resistance front to confront Israel's savageries and its plot to break the will of resilient Gazans. The Israeli attack on Monday left seven Iranian military advisers dead, including Major General Mohammad Reza Zahedi. We were earlier joined by political commentator Ali Salam about the recent Israeli attack on Iran's diplomatic mission in Syria. He said an Iranian response is certain and that the resistance forces of the region will be on the side of Iran.
What's important is what the leader of the Islamic Revolution and Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah have said in the past couple of days, and that this is a certainty. A response is a certainty. If Iran steps in and then there's a retaliation, although we can't really call the actions of an illegitimate military occupation, which is the Zionist regime, we can't call them a retaliation. Everything they do is criminal. Everything they do is illegitimate. They will essentially, the resistance forces of the region will be on the side of Iran. And so it's not just going to be something that is going to be a bilateral conflict. It's going to involve basically everybody pouring in on the Zionist regime, and perhaps this being the one of the final, or if not the final, liberation battle for the Palestinian people, and to safeguard the Al-Aqsa Mosque, which is very holy for the Muslims, and the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, which is holy for the Christians, because the Zionist regime threatens both of those. But the thing is that Iran is not reckless. Iran is not seeking blood. Iran knows that it's kind of like if there's a giant war. Yes, they have the capabilities to destroy Israel, but we don't want to underestimate these terrorist regimes. So Iran is the more rational actor. These people in the Zionist regime, you see what they have done to children. A normal human being who isn't totally psychopathic, isn't totally drowned by satanic thoughts, is the one who's more bloodthirsty, the one who is not rational, the one who's going to increase escalation. The only factor in this region that is de-escalatory is the Islamic Republic of Iran.
The Islamic Resistance in Iraq says it has carried out a fresh strike on an Israeli target in the occupied Palestine. The Iraqi Resistance said it launched a drone attack against a vital target in the Umm al-Rashrash port city, which the regime calls Eilat. It said the attack was in response to the massacres committed by Israel against Palestinian civilians, including women, children and the elderly. The group said it will continue with its operations as long as the regime continues with its bloodshed in Gaza. In recent months, the Islamic Resistance, an umbrella group in Iraq, has conducted a series of attacks against Israeli positions. It has also hit U.S. military bases in Iraq and neighboring Syria in retaliation for Washington's support for the Israeli genocide in Gaza. The U.S.-Israeli genocidal war is raging on in the besieged Gaza Strip amid international calls for a ceasefire. As the onslaught continues, more people are joining calls to boycott the regime. We've looked into how the boycott has expanded since October the 7th in our Explainer program. Let's take a look.
The boycott of Israeli products or companies that end up putting money in Israel's coffers has been in the making for decades. But does it really work? In other words, have any of the boycotts led to Israel's bottom line being affected, namely their income? And how has Operation Al-Aqsa Flood given momentum to the boycott now approaching the 6th month? Well, the different areas where the boycott takes place needs to be first covered. These would be things like economic, government boycotts, academic, and even military. Even though the economic boycott has been the focus, boycotts in other sections have increased significantly since U.S.-Israel genocidal aggression, which began on October 31st, gave momentum to that. Now, let's take a look at the state and at the local levels. Here you can see what we're looking at. For example, Bahrain, Bolivia, Colombia, Chad, Chile, suspended diplomatic relations with Israel. Chile, Colombia, Honduras, Turkey, and Jordan to have downgraded relations with the Israeli regime. The city of Barcelona in Catalonia has also severed all ties with Israel. And these diplomatic fallouts have just begun since Israel has shown no interest in an agreement with Hamas. Well, the military boycott, even though it's not covered in detail, but it has been making news somewhat in terms of the countries that have boycotted Israel. For example, we're looking at Canada, Denmark, and Italy to have halted arms sales. In terms of Denmark and Italy, they've actually suspended their arms exports. Meanwhile, countries are also stopping their military purchases from Israel, such as Colombia. And the EU is actually looking at what the EU Association Treaty with Israel is in terms of suspending it, and that would be a major blow to Israel. Perhaps the biggest win for the different boycott movements have been economic ones. These are some of the well-known brands that I'm sure you're familiar with: McDonald's, Starbucks, Burger King, Pizza Hut, Puma, and Carrefour, the French supermarket giant. And they're just a few of the many that people have boycotted. Well, let's look at just a couple of examples in terms of the impact. We're looking at poor sales for companies like Starbucks in West Asia and North Africa. It's managed by the franchise operator Alshaya Group, and it has laid off 2,000 workers. That's roughly 10% of its workforce. So effective was the McDonald's boycott. Take a look at what has happened. McDonald's has announced that it would buy all 225 restaurants from the Israel franchise. So obviously, there's an impact there. One not talked about much: Norway's sovereign fund, the world's largest, has divested entirely. It's almost $500 million worth of Israeli bonds. Now, Israel needs to sell bonds in order to fund the genocidal aggression. Also, several Danish pension funds have excluded Israeli companies, including banks, who are involved in Israel's illegal settlements. Well, institutions like trade unions or faith, academic, cultural ones, and even sports have also seen a spike in boycotts in one form or another. Taking a look at the universities, well, gosh, there's so many we can't mention all of them, so we'll just let it scroll. There's tens of thousands of artists also who have continued, in addition to the universities, calling for a boycott with an Israeli ban from FIFA and even the Olympics to be in the works. Now, that's unprecedented. Well, the losses have accumulated for Israel. Taking a look at what they need to do, first of all, it's $10.5 billion in losses, and they need $33 million just to fight off the boycott campaign. So you can see that obviously has been a major impact in their bottom line. And when you take a look at some of the other incidents that we couldn't cover, well, it's just too much to say the least that the boycott campaign has worked.
A large demonstration in solidarity with Gaza was held in Austria's capital, Vienna, to mark International Quds Day. Protesters demanded an immediate ceasefire in Gaza and showed solidarity with Palestinians in the besieged territory as Israel's war continues to claim civilian lives. Our correspondent, Dieter Reinisch, reports from Vienna.
Thousands of Austrians marched under the slogan "Stop the genocide, stop the occupation" in the capital, Vienna. The Palestine Committee and Palestine Solidarity Austria organized the demonstration. The march was held on Saturday, a week after house raids of Palestinian activists in the city of Linz. Police recently also interrogated protesters in other cities. International Quds Day was an aspiration for the organizers of Saturday's protest.
And all these commemoration days is to really say, wake up, we are really in the situation where people are getting killed every day and we have to stop it as soon as possible.
Organizers also criticized a four-day visit of the President of the Austrian Parliament, Wolfgang Sobotka, to Israel this week.
Well, obviously, when looking at the last 6 months, there's been some unconditional support for Israel, obviously, and their action in the Gaza Strip, which is absolutely unacceptable.
Several speakers stressed Austrian solidarity with Palestinians in war-torn Gaza as the U.S.-Israeli genocidal war continues unabated. They said the Austrian government does not speak for them.
It's the most obvious wrongdoing that I've ever seen in my life.
The protesters called for support for Lebanon and Yemen against U.S. imperialist aggression. People from around the world joined the Vienna march.
I was born in Chile under a dictatorship and I have a lot of Palestinian friends. I am even wearing a t-shirt from a team called Palestina, who was founded by Palestinian migrants several years ago. I couldn't be in peace with myself if I wasn't here demonstrating and saying and raising my voice at least.
Representatives of Jewish organizations such as Not In Our Name stressed their continued solidarity with the Palestinian struggles. Organizers said all Austrians must continue to protest against the U.S.-Israeli genocide and their government support for it, despite the repression.
We cannot call ourselves humans, regardless of our nationalities or political views or religions, and be indifferent about what's going on nowadays in Gaza.
Thousands marched in the Austrian capital Vienna in support of the people and the resistance in Gaza as the Israeli genocide war claims more civilian lives. Despite Austria's repression, the state and the police were unable to stop the Palestine solidarity movement. Saturday's demonstration has once again shown that the support for Gaza remains strong in Austria. Dieter Reinisch, Vienna.
With that, we come to the end of this bulletin. Thank you for listening. Take care and bye-bye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. You early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Since the Zionist regime's genocide against Palestinians in Gaza in mid-October, the regime's military has laid waste to much of the Gaza enclave's north, badly damaging more than half of the buildings and large swathes of entire neighborhoods. Ashifa, the largest hospital in Gaza, had already been under immense strain in the first stages of the war, with bodies piling up after food, fuel, and anesthetics ran out. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote, Salem Baraka has seen the kind of horror no parent should ever have to endure. The Israeli military killed his son Karim right in front of him. Like so many others, Salem and Karim fled from their home in Jabalia refugee camp, northern Gaza, during the current genocidal war. They took shelter at Ashifa, Gaza's largest hospital. They were inside the hospital when it was stormed by Israeli regime forces on March 18th. Salem recalled how he spent the following week waiting to die. Quadcopter drones were firing widely, striking anything that moved, he said, adding, "The Israelis smashed the glass in the windows and destroyed the walls in the department where we were hiding. A shell fell on us and killed my son in front of my eyes," he said. "I could not save him. He bled to death." The situation in Solomon's wards was worse than hell. Among the terrible scenes he witnessed were Israeli regime tanks driving over the bodies of people who had been killed in the hospital's courtyard. Because the hospital could not function, infection soared among people who were wounded. In many cases, injured people were devoured by worms due to the lack of treatment. After the hospital had been under siege for approximately a week, the Zionist regime forces used loudspeakers to summon everyone in the courtyard. The Palestinian men were ordered to strip. They were beaten. Women were subjected to both verbal and physical abuse, according to Salem. Salem recalled that he trembled in horror when one of the soldiers called my name. He was interrogated for around 48 hours. "I was not allowed to sit down or turn to the left or right," he said. "My hands were tied behind my back. I was blindfolded and completely naked." Salem added that he repeatedly heard gunfire and that his interrogator threatened to kill my wife, who is ill and lives with her family in northern Gaza, if I did not cooperate. He said, "Throughout the interrogation, I was thinking about where the soldier would shoot me, in the head, chest, or heart. I did not believe him when he said the interrogation was over. I realized that I had miraculously survived death." Salem was given a choice of evacuating to southern Gaza or being killed. Before leaving, Salem asked that he be allowed to see the body of his son, Karim, 13. Salem wanted to say a final goodbye and bury his child. The Israeli regime forces rejected his request. Salem said, "I never expected that I would lose him at such an early age. He was a handsome boy who loved football and dreamed of becoming a famous player." Salem had to walk for hours until he reached Rafah, Gaza's southernmost city. Although some counseling has been arranged for him in Rafah, it is clearly inadequate given the trauma he and so many others are going through. Salem now finds himself without his wife and is struggling to accept the reality that his son is dead. The Zionist regime had completely destroyed the hospital by the time its forces withdrew in the early hours of Monday. Karim Baraka is among several hundred people who were slaughtered during Israel's two-week siege on Ashifa. The child killer regime of Israel's attack on the hospital is one of the worst massacres in Palestinian history. It is a crime against humanity, committed after the International Court of Justice had instructed the Zionist regime to stop killing Palestinians. Meanwhile, Middle East Eye reported hours after Israeli regime forces ended their siege on Ashifa Hospital, Palestinians are facing the difficult task of trying to locate survivors buried under rubble without search and rescue teams. Hundreds of displaced Palestinians returned to their homes near Ashifa Hospital recently to find bodies strewn inside and outside the facility after Israeli regime forces withdrew from the area. Earlier in the day, the Zionist regime forces ended their 14-day siege of the hospital, leaving Gaza's largest medical complex in shambles and entire neighborhoods in ruins. The Israeli regime army claimed its devastating offensive was a success and said, without providing any evidence, that its forces had killed more than 200 Palestinian fighters and arrested hundreds more. But locals told Middle East Eye that the raid had decimated much of the sprawling Ashrafa hospital complex and nearby residential areas, with scores of civilians trapped amid the rubble of crumbled apartment blocks. Hundreds of locals who converged on the area found the scene of devastation, with charred buildings, mounds of dirt that had been churned up by bulldozers and wounded Palestinians on stretchers. Local resident Ahmad Abdul Wahi told MEE that he spent much of the morning with his friends searching through the ruins of the four-story tower block where his family once lived in the hope of finding loved ones still alive. Several members of Abdul Wahid's family are still missing following the Zionist regime's devastating siege on the neighborhood, including his sister and four of her young children. Picking through the rubble and twisted metal of their home with his bare hands, he said the bodies of four Palestinians were recovered after a lengthy search. Nearby, corpses, some covered in dirty blankets, lay scattered around the charred hulk of burnt-out buildings. The ground was heavily plowed up, and numerous buildings were either flattened close to falling or burnt down completely. Abdul Wahid told MEE, "I went to my sister's house with a friend, but their home was completely destroyed. We managed to recover four bodies out of 24. There is no civil defense or tools, excavators, so we had to use our hands and simple tools. The ones we managed to rescue were close to the surface."
This is A to Z. An introduction into Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, your day in the holy month of Ramadan must be different from your other days. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, such an honor to be here, holy month of Ramadan, with you, dear listeners. May Allah accept all of your worship and your obedience and your prayers and all of the things that you did in the servitude to the Almighty Allah in this holy month of Ramadan. Allah bless you and Ramadan Kareem. So we are talking about how our day in the holy month of Ramadan should be different than the rest of our other days. So sure, this is one of those statements that perhaps we should have said in the beginning of the holy month of Ramadan, but I believe everybody says this statement in the beginning of the holy month of Ramadan. Very rarely do people say it towards the end of the holy month of Ramadan. So why would we want to choose to bring this statement at the end of the holy month of Ramadan? Well, so that we can take this statement, and because we've been purified for so many days, you know, alhamdulillah, by the grace and blessings of Allah, now towards the end of holy month of Ramadan, we will put this in our mind and kind of keep it in our mind, and we're kind of going to think about it, and we're going to want to implement it in these last few days. And then after the holy month of Ramadan, we will continue this lesson that our days in the holy month of Ramadan must be different than our other days. And of course, you know, you might be asking, well, where is this statement from? I'm surprised that you don't know, but it's okay. Sometimes you forget. So this is a tradition from the sixth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ja'far as-Sadiq alayhi salam, where His Eminence says that the day of your fasting should not be like any ordinary day. When you fast, all of your senses, your eyes, your ears, your tongue, your hands, and your feet must also fast with you. So this is the tradition from the sixth divinely appointed Imam, who talks about how our day when we fast in the holy month of Ramadan, for example, should not be like any other ordinary day.
Ramadan al-mustabin jaa bin nur al-mubin. Ramadan, Ramadan, Ramadan al-qanitin.
Welcome back. This is A to Z on IRIB English Radio. So, dear friends, we are talking about how our day in the holy month of Ramadan should not be like our other ordinary days, right? So, in our other ordinary days, we're kind of ghafil, we're negligent, we're careless. You know, we don't really realize, is God watching us or He's not watching us? We commit sins. You know, we don't think twice about the sins that we are committing. We don't think twice about the sins we've committed in the past. You know, for example, we don't think about thanking the Almighty Allah for the blessings that He has given us, you know. Or our other ordinary days, we're committing sins with our hands and our ears, and we're going to places we shouldn't be going, and we're listening to things we shouldn't be listening. So our ordinary day, to be honest with you, after listing just a few of these things, our ordinary day seems to be a pretty bad day. And what's even worse is that we don't realize that this kind of a bad day is what we're living like an ordinary day. This should be an abnormal day for us. But unfortunately, because of the materialistic aspect and the desires and the lowly desires and these, you know, passions that try to control us, because of all these different reasons, we have turned this abnormal day into ordinary day. Well, the holy month of Ramadan and all of these days after purification has taught us that the holy month of Ramadan days are our ordinary days. Those are the days that we should really have. And it is these kind of days that we need to live for the rest of our life. Our Islamic lifestyle days should be like our days in the holy month of Ramadan. And of course, our days in the holy month of Ramadan must not be like our, you know, ordinary / abnormal days that we live.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
In the Limelight.
In the United States, a judge has denied all eight of Hunter Biden's motions to dismiss his tax indictments. The ruling paves the way for a 20th of June trial for President Biden's son, Hunter Biden. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The national broadcaster ABC News has covered this story and tells us more. A judge late on Monday, 1st of April, denied all eight of Hunter Biden's motions to dismiss his nine-count tax indictment in California, paving the way for a 20th of June trial. Hunter Biden, the son of President Joe Biden, had sought dismissal of the case earlier this year, arguing in part that prosecutors succumbed to political pressure in filing charges against him, that an ill-fated immunity agreement struck with prosecutors last summer remained in effect, and that the charges were brought in an improper venue. In an 82-page ruling posted to the case docket late on Monday, 1st of April, Judge Mark Scarsi denied all eight motions by Hunter Biden. "We strongly disagree with the court's decision and will continue to vigorously pursue Hunter Biden's challenges to the abnormal way the special counsel handled his investigation and charged this case," Hunter Biden's attorney Abby Lowell said in a statement following the ruling. The younger Biden had argued that the immunity stipulation in a section of the party's ill-fated plea deal from last summer remains in effect. His legal team wrote that the tax charges violate the terms of the diversion agreement and accused prosecutors of attempting to backtrack and renege on the deal. Special Counsel David Weiss, in his rebuttal filed last month, slammed Hunter Biden's arguments in court filings as a conspiracy theory, a house of cards, and shape-shifting claims. David Weiss claimed that it was Hunter Biden and not the prosecutors who walked away from negotiations. David Weiss's office proposed changes to the agreements after the 26th of July hearing, where the deal fell apart, he wrote. "The defendant rejected these counter-proposals and refused further negotiations," David Weiss wrote. David Weiss made additional rebuttals to many of the other motions to dismiss, which included claims of improper venue and statute of limitations. David Weiss's office charged Hunter Biden in December with nine felony and misdemeanor charges stemming from his failure to pay a $1.4 million tax charges for 3 years during a time when he was in the throes of addiction. Hunter Biden has pleaded not guilty to all the charges against him. The back taxes and penalties were previously paid in full by a third party, identified by ABC News as Hunter Biden's attorney and confidant Kevin Morris. The federal judge overseeing this case will hold a hearing on these arguments later on this month. CNN cable news network has also covered the same story and tells us more. A federal judge has denied Hunter Biden's attempts to throw out his felony tax indictment, paving the way for a trial in June. The judge, who was skeptical of Hunter Biden's arguments at a hearing last week in Los Angeles, California, rejected eight motions to dismiss in a sweeping 82-page ruling issued on Monday, 1st of April. President Joe Biden's son, Hunter Biden, has pleaded not guilty to all nine charges against him. He is accused of repeatedly failing to file and pay his taxes on time and engaging in an illegal tax evasion scheme by filing false tax returns and cooking the books on his company's payroll. In a victory for Special Counsel David Weiss, U.S. District Judge Mark Scarsi rejected Hunter Biden's arguments that the felony indictment was politically motivated. Judge Scarsi said Hunter Biden's lawyers provided virtually no evidence to back their theory that David Weiss's team exhibited anti-Biden bias, and that a rigorous standard must be met before indictment can be thrown out on these grounds. The judge blasted Hunter Biden's lawyers for relying on a hodgepodge of news articles and social media posts to push the theory that David Weiss brought the charges because he caved to pressure from former President Donald Trump and from congressional Republicans, which David Weiss's prosecutors have called a conspiracy theory. The motion is remarkable in that it fails to include a single declaration, exhibit, or request for judicial notice, the judge wrote. Instead, the defendant cites portions of various internet news sources, social media posts, and legal blogs. These citations, however, are not evidence in a court of law. Judge Scarsi also roundly rejected Hunter Biden's assertion that David Weiss was improperly appointed special counsel, writing that Hunter Biden's attorneys offered no convincing reason as to why he shouldn't have been appointed. Hunter Biden's lead attorney, Abby Lowell, said in a statement that the rulings, "We strongly disagree with the court's decision and will continue to vigorously pursue Hunter Biden's challenges to the abnormal way the special counsel handled this investigation and charged this case." As he suggested at last week's hearing, Judge Scarsi also disagreed with Hunter Biden's arguments that the case should be thrown out because of the actions of two Internal Revenue Service agents who previously worked on the investigation. Those Internal Revenue Service officials have since become whistleblowers, accused prosecutors of going soft on Hunter Biden, and were featured at GOP-run congressional hearings. Aside from failing to substantiate his allegations that the IRS agents influenced the prosecutorial decision with anything but speculation, the defendant offers no case in which a court exercised supervisory powers to dismiss an indictment due to conduct that impacts the fundamental decision to prosecute, the judge wrote. The judge concluded the theory lacked merit and that he wouldn't have the power to toss the case even if it did. Judge Scarsi also shut down attempts by Hunter Biden to dismiss some of the lesser charges in the 9-count indictment against him. The judge ruled that the statute of limitations hadn't run out on the misdemeanor charges relating to Hunter Biden's 2016 taxes. He also ruled that there wasn't enough evidence disputing Hunter Biden's California residency to throw out 4 counts over potential jurisdictional problems. Judge Scarsi's findings offer vindication for Special Prosecutor David Weiss, a Republican who was appointed by Donald Trump to his former post as U.S. Attorney in Delaware. David Weiss's prosecutors have defended the integrity and non-partisan nature of their work and said in court last week that it was insulting to suggest they were taking their cues from Donald Trump or from Republican lawmakers. In a slew of court filings after the tax case was initially brought, defense attorneys for Hunter Biden claimed that Special Prosecutor David Weiss was improperly appointed, alleged that the case is political, and pushed the judge to dismiss the case for conflicting with a plea deal that collapsed over the summer. Special Prosecutor David Weiss ridiculed Hunter Biden's arguments as legally baseless and steeped in a conspiracy theory. As part of his ruling on Monday, 1st of April, Judge Scarsi found that while Hunter Biden and the prosecutors did strike a diversion agreement over the summer in the president's son would avoid tax charges, the agreement and its immunity provisions never went into effect because the line where a probation officer was supposed to sign is blank. The deal that David Weiss and Hunter Biden struck, Judge Scarsi wrote, stipulated a probation officer must sign the paperwork for the agreement to take effect. Nothing in the text of the diversion agreement tethers the very existence of the agreement or any party's acceptance of the agreement to the probation officer's approval, Judge Scarzi wrote. But David Weiss and Hunter Biden made the performance of their obligations contingent upon the event of her signing. What was left, Judge Scarzi wrote, was that Hunter Biden's immunity in its current form was not valid.
Welcome to the Israel Watch. In this episode, we address several topics, including the blatant Zionist attack on the Iranian consulate in Damascus. We also discuss the negotiations for a captive exchange deal, holding Netanyahu responsible for its failure, as well as Washington's decision to supply arms to the entity. Additionally, former military and security officials admit the failure to eliminate the resistance in Gaza. I'd like to go ahead and welcome my guest today, Mr. Ali Imrad, researcher and writer. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
We begin today with the Zionist attack targeting the Iranian consulate in Damascus, which resulted in the martyrdom of 7 advisors from the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. Zionist media confirmed the responsibility of the Israeli entity for this attack. Well, Mr. Murad, what is your opinion of Taimir Hayman's expression of the Zionist pain on the axis of resistance and its open front? He actually considered the attack on the consulate in Damascus as a way or a direct way of paying the price.
Since he's talking about paying price speaking about pain inflicted on the Zionist entity, he's in a way acknowledging that those generals, and on top of them, martyr general Zahidi, if they weren't making Israel pay this much of price and this much of pain, they wouldn't have been attacked in the first place. So this is an acknowledgement from a high general, though he is retired, but he works in a think tank. He is on the top of a think tank that provides policy papers to the Israeli government.
And well, actually, as we know, the Zionists recently mentioned in media that, according to their information, the consulate was not a consulate. It was, in fact, a military base. What is your opinion?
This is something that Iran decides and the Syrian authorities. It is well known that this is a building for the Iranian consulate in Damascus, in the Syrian capital. No matter what the Zionist liars are saying, what matters in the end of the day, what Iran will provide to the United Nations prior to the meeting that is going to take place to discuss this dangerous terrorist attack on a consulate of a sovereign nation, which is clearly is a violation of the so-called international law, because as you can see, up to now, the Zionist entity has put this international law in the garbage in all means, whether by attacking hospitals in Gaza, whether by killing tens of thousands of civilians, and now by attacking consulates and diplomatic buildings
in other countries. With increasing internal demands to stop the war in Gaza, university professors in Zionist universities signed a petition to President Biden demanding to halt the supply of weapons to the entity due to the genocide in Gaza. Mr. Murad, do these drastic measures from the Zionist academic circles stem from their fears of the current situation in the conflict and the entity's well-being?
Of course, because if you take a look at the universities and historically, there would be a block inside those universities, academics or students who have leftist ideas and currents. So they try to raise their voices, but on the real theater, what happens in the end of the day is that the Washington will still provide the Zionists with the weapons. Billions of dollars are being funneled to the defense industrial military complex.
Well, Mr. Murad, as you're mentioning here, I do want to go over to our next lead, which is going to emphasize more on this point. These demands to stop supplying the occupation army with American weapons were met with a decision from the Biden administration to send more fighter jets, missiles, and ammunition. Mr. Murad, how do you interpret Biden's supplying of more ammunition despite Netanyahu's claims of a disagreement on the course of what's going on in Gaza?
I think the history is repeating itself, because if you go back years ago with the Obama administration, when they had this dispute with Netanyahu concerning the Iran nuclear deal, by September 2016, they were clashing in the media. So in September 14th, the Obama administration declared that they would be aiding Israel, the Zionist entity, with $40 billion for the next 10 years. And the clash continued. What I want to say is that this is how things are being done in Washington, in a way that they split. When they are talking about the so-called national security of Israel, they are committed to continue to supply Israel with financial aid, with weapons and arms. And when they talk about tactics, political tactics, disputes concerning some certain issues, they continue to talk about it, like what it's taking place concerning the Rafah operation now.
Exactly. With that, let's go ahead and move over now to Zionist social media platforms, which are filled with calls for toppling Netanyahu. And here are some comments.
Aja, we must hold elections to save what remains of Israel and to save the captives. Liaga, there is a need to change the regime. We will not allow Netanyahu to waste more time. We want a ceasefire immediately. Sarah, the extreme right-wing government has caused the loss of many captives. We must protest to overthrow this government.
Mr. Murad, where are the protests against Netanyahu heading? As we know, they've gone from peaceful to more violent.
Well, you know, before the October 7th Operation Al-Aqsa Flood, there were marches in the streets of the cities and the settlements. There's a big block inside the Zionist entity who want Netanyahu to step aside, to go into early elections, to elect someone who would take the Zionist entity back to where it was.
Well, as you mentioned, the early elections, Netanyahu actually mentioned this and said that early elections are not a solution, but rather war will be bringing back the captives.
Because, you know, he knows the day he accepts to go to the early elections, he would go home. Because all the polls suggest that Netanyahu is losing. He has been losing since the beginning of the war. And now, right now, in the best case scenario, he would have 17 MKs.
But also the Americans seem not to be wanting Netanyahu at the moment.
Yeah, you know, the Americans know that Benny Gantz has been gaining popularity inside the Zionist entity, and that's why he was invited to the White House. All the polls suggest that the party that Gantz leads is going to lead in the next election, whether it happens now or it happens months later or next year. Because the way Netanyahu is managing this war is convincing more Israelis and more settlers that the right, led by Netanyahu, is taking Israel to a place, to a very dangerous place, where there might be an escalation of a wide regional war.
Well, as you mentioned, Mr. Murad, from the elections, let's move over to another crisis, which is the crisis of the Haredi enlistment, which is worsening day by day, and the voices of senior rabbis rejecting enlistment are increasing. The rabbi prefers religious youth to go to prison rather being enlisted inside of the army. What is the horizon on the crisis, in your opinion?
I think this crisis has always been inside the Zionist entity. It has been controlled since the establishment of this Zionist entity. Right now, because the army generals need more staff, more soldiers to be enlisted, because they got thousands of injured and wounded and killed, and psychologically affected soldiers, they need more enlisted soldiers. So they got no more. So they said, we have to go to the Haredi society to enlist from those religious
factors.
So I think this has to deal with the very existence of Israel, because those Haredis, they compose like 2 millions or maybe 1.5 million. We are talking about a huge portion of the Israeli society. So this is going to be the mother of the crisis, I think.
More in Israel, where the protests against Netanyahu, where the families of the captives participate, continue, and they have begun to take on a non-peaceful character, and threats of resorting to violence until a captive exchange deal is concluded and Netanyahu's government is toppled. Negotiations are ongoing for a captive exchange deal, highlighting the issue of the return of Palestinians to the northern Gaza Strip, as demanded by the resistance, while the occupation forces persist in rejecting this demand. Mr. Murad, is it possible for the other side to agree to such Zionist conditions?
The resistance has been clear since the first day. You cannot have those hostages or prisoners, Israeli prisoners, without fulfilling the demands of the resistance. Netanyahu, of course, tried to put more factors and more status quo to make it harder to reach a deal, because his real intentions is that all the captives, all the hostages, will die under bombardment, or whether starvation or by diseases, so that he would make the resistance lose this paper, this paper of power, because the resistance has been calibrating the negotiations cleverly and smart, and that's why I think the streets are being filled with protesters every day, protesting and demanding that Netanyahu would leave and leave the issue of negotiations, because his real intentions are not to reach a deal. He doesn't want to reach a deal, because he is using the starvation as a weapon of war in this negotiations, and he is trying to tell the Palestinians in Gaza that you cannot return to the northern part of Gaza Strip unless you return those hostages. This is not going to happen.
So Netanyahu has his own agenda.
Yeah.
The demand for Arab forces to be sent to Gaza and the West Bank was made by 5 Arab ministers who met with U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken in Cairo during his recent visit to the region. Mr. Murad, what implications can be drawn from the leaked information by the Zionist media regarding the request of foreign ministers of Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Qatar, and the UAE to send Arab forces to Gaza and the West Bank?
It doesn't tell something new, because we all know that those Arab countries, they want to normalize relations with the Zionist entity, no matter those Zionists are committing genocide in Gaza, no matter there is more than 35,000 martyrs and more than 75 wounded. They don't care to the feelings of the Palestinians in the first place, and the Arab masses, because they are acting the same way as the American agenda is telling them to act, because they want to reach a peace agreement, emphasize the Saudis and the Zionists, so that the Zionist entity would not take the